Okay, so this is part four of the speakers test questions that we've been going through over the last couple of months since November. We found when doing these questions that quite a lot of people want to talk, which is great. So what we'll do is we'll use the speaking queue. We don't always do that on an FAQ on a Wednesday, but for these sort of sessions, it seems like a good idea. So if everyone's clicked in the speaking queue, we can start. Does anybody want to do the honours for the speaking queue? I can do it, but it's technically a bit tricky for me to do it. Anybody? No, right, I'll just do it then. Okay, so has everybody got, or have they all lost, has everyone lost your copy of the speaker's test question since the last time we did this? It was a while ago. I've posted a... Steve, you need to mute your microphone. Oh, there we go. yeah, I've just in case you've lost it, I've posted a new link in the Useful Links channel. Just click that link and it's like a shortcut and it'll take you back to the original posting in November, and you can download the questions from there. Incidentally, do feel free to use video if you want to. Some members told us in the recent questionnaire that they prefer video to just audio. And Discord does do video, although it didn't do when we first started out with this server back in March last year. We started out with just audio on Discord because we thought it might be better for bandwidth. But to be honest, it probably doesn't make much difference unless you've got like hundreds of people. Zoom manages perfectly well with video. Well, I haven't got a webcam myself and no particular desire to get one, but there's nothing stopping anyone here putting their smiling cherubic faces up for the rest of us to see if you would like to. I just thought I'd mention that in case anyone thinks that there's, you know, some kind of audio only rule going on that must not be transgressed on pain of death, except of course by Joel, who is transgresses it all the time. Now, before we start, I've mentioned this before in previous sessions like this, but would anyone be interested in actually taking this speaker's test for real? To get accreditation as a speaker for doing debates, standing in elections, or, you know, just for the hell of it. I don't think this would be a purely academic exercise. When the pandemic's over, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we as a party really want to go out there and put on quite a few public meetings to get ourselves back out in front of the public again. So it might be really a case of all hands on deck, and the more accredited speakers we've got, the better. And I also think it might be quite a bit of a confidence boost for some members, you know, who haven't done much public speaking or any public speaking before. If we've got a few people who want to do it, me and Steve will organise some workshop sessions on Discord. We'd be really happy to do that. Whereas in these sessions, these FAQs, we've been discussing the speaker's questions just, you know, for the sake of interest, really. The aim of the workshops would be to sort of distill good answers to the questions into just a sentence or two, you know, maybe with some topical examples from the news and, you know, quoting relevant facts and figures where appropriate. So it would be more of a study type thing rather than a kind of discursive thing. Anyway, if anybody's interested in doing that, do let me know. Send me or Steve, C. Finch, a message either on here or email or something like that. We can start taking names and writing them in our little black book and organising some workshops. I think it would be something. Some people in the questionnaire also said that they'd like to see some more sort of training kind of sessions in Discord, you know. We think this would be a really good example of a training session that members might quite enjoy as well. So, you know, if you fancy having a go at it, give us a shout. Give me or Steve Vince a shout. Okay, so last time we finished up with question 26. So where we're going to start now is, you guessed it, question 27. And speaking cue button at the ready, everybody. So just stick your cue in the speaking cue if you want to speak. Question 27 then. You sound like anarchists. Are you? Okay, who wants to be the first with that? Oh, Brian was in there very quick. Brian Johnson.
Yes, because this is exactly a question that was posed to me during when the elections that we held or contested during South Wales by one of the BBC presenters, Jason Mohammed. He's gone from BBC Wales now, which is with BBC Sport, but nevertheless. And my response was that, no, to be quite frank and historical, this comes, in actual fact, this question, you know, refers to the socialist case, not the anarchist case. The anarchists have taken this up in many instances in regards to the takeover of the state, etc. Right. And historically, the anarchist case came out of the socialist case. Socialism was first, then anarchism after. So anything that looks like is pointing to the anarchist case, in actual fact, historically points to the socialist case.
Could that not look a bit like...
I was a lot briefer than that.
Could that not look a bit like Yarbu, we were there first?
Yes, correct. Yeah, that's the way I put it. You know, that there. But it is a fact, like, you know, that the anarchist case comes out the socialist case.
But wouldn't it be more...
And we were there first.
Okay, but wouldn't it be more useful to actually explain, you know, if you're talking to audiences, actually explain what anarchism is and what socialism is, rather than talk about sort of historical precedent? Do you not think?
Yes, if you're talking to an audience, yes, of course you are. But I wasn't. The audience that I was talking to was just a 3-4 minute interview on BBC Wales. You know, so I didn't have much time at all, right, to discuss the ins and outs of and the differences between anarchism and socialism. Not that there are that many differences, to be quite honest.
Because I would have just said off the cuff, yeah, we're the same except we stand in elections and they mostly don't. But that's perhaps being a bit too simplistic. Does anybody else want to say anything on this?
Can I? Sorry, I just don't know how to put my hand up because I'm a bit rubbish on my phone. but I was about to say that I always believe that the Socialist Party was more anarchist than the anarchists, really. I think that the our party is so anarchic and so equal that the only way that we can use is parliament, but only to put our hands up and all agree with something. So yeah, rather than the anarchists, you know, lack of hierarchy, but almost hierarchy by the person who has the biggest personality. We don't do that in the party. We do it by voting equally.
Okay, more anarchist than the anarchists. I like that approach. Howard, you did an FAQ on this very subject quite recently. Really good one, actually. So people should listen to that.
Right. My quick fire answer would be, no, we don't regard it as anarchism, since anarchists usually think in terms of violent revolution, whereas we see the free access, cooperative kind of society we want as arising through majority democratic action. ideally through elections. That's my quick-fire answer. It sort of damns the anarchists a bit, I know, because they don't always think in terms of violent revolution, but nevertheless, okay, it's one way of sort of contrasting us with anarchists.
I suppose there's also the thing, isn't it, that anarchists are, you know, all things to all people, really, as well. It's very difficult to generalise.
But by the way, Paddy, is there a list of questions somewhere that we can access?
There's always one. Yes, I've already explained this. It's in the. I put a link in the useful links. It's a shortcut to the original posting. So just click it, and it'll go to the original posting, and you can.
All right, sorry.
I can download it. If there's nobody else on this particular question, it's not a particularly contentious question, is it? Oh, hang on. Brian wants to come in. Brian?
Yeah, just to mention, to point out the essential difference between us and the anarchists is that we are into a structure, whereas the anarchists are more familiar with structurelessness, right? Very unlikely to get organized. It appears, you know, that historically they're against organization.
Okay, I think that's a very contentious statement. And I'll just give you a little anecdote about that. When the Lancaster branch of the Socialist Party once played the local Lancaster anarchists at a game of football on a Sunday afternoon, and the anarchists absolutely slaughtered us. We were useless. I mean, it was comical to watch. And one of their lot, came over to help in our team because we were so bad. And he said, I think what you lot are lacking is a bit of organisation. Anyway, Jane and Tony have got a question. Jane and Tony?
I was just an observation, really. I mean, it's nonsense to say that. I mean, as somebody who's been an anarchist or close to anarchism most of my life, I can say that, yeah, a lot of anarchists are not into being organised, but there are quite a lot of anarchists who are very much into being organised, like the syndicalists and people like that. As somebody pointed out, it's, I mean, it seems to me the fundamental difference between SPGB and anarchists is that you believe in getting elected, and anarchists believe in creating an anarchist society by a mass movement from below and not going through the parliamentary road. I mean, this also has to be pointed out that that not all anarchists are necessarily against voting at all. Quite a lot of anarchist organisations work on the basis of voting and would expect that whatever structure arises in the process of creating a new society would operate by some form of voting. I mean, I've met very few anarchists who just think, oh, let's have a party and just do our own thing. They're a very small minority, usually lost in a lifestyle bubble. That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
Like it. Good.
Totally agree.
Lorna, can you work out where the speaking cue is? Because that's what we're going to use just to be systematic.
Sorry, I really can't. Can you tell me how I do it?
Speaking cue is a channel just above general discussion where you're at now. It's a text channel. All we have to do is put a letter Q in it or something so we know we're doing that, so everybody can take turns speaking. Steve Finch.
Yeah, just one thing that's not been mentioned. We don't go for parliamentary votes because we want parliamentary votes. We go to capture the states, so to prevent it being used against us. And I think that's got become even more important these days, as well as to test the ideas of the working class. And we've got to say that as a party, we never ask anybody for a vote. We ask them for the for the reflection and to think about what the class interests are. So this idea, I mean, there's so much bollocks talked about the parliamentary. But I was looking at something, this book, he was talking so much bollocks about the way that you cannot use the democratic processes that we've got. Unbelievable. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, and Richard. Oh, hang on.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, good.
Right, lovely. I would say, me personally, I mean, my understanding is that the difference between myself as an SPGBer and an anarchist is our attitude towards the state. I think it's very simple. I think the anarchists actually believe the state fundamentally is the problem. At least every anarchist I've ever met, of any particular denomination of anarchists, they always regard the state as the problem, and their first objection is to the state. Whereas in our analysis, we actually regard capitalism itself as the problem, and the state as an expression of that. And many anarchists that I know simply dismiss the idea that it all actually happens in production. In capitalist production, and that is in fact the state that actually, some of them even have a what I would term almost a conspiracy theory that in fact it was the state that actually engineered capitalism in the first place. So I'm not saying they all believe that, but I know plenty that do. So that would be my answer to that, and the fact, of course, that we actually believe in utilizing the state as a means to getting towards socialism by a mass movement, just as anarchists believe in a mass movement, we believe in a mass movement, but we use and utilizing the state in order to prevent it being used against us, whether they don't. I wouldn't agree with almost everything else that's been actually said about the difference between us.
Okay, John Cumming.
I think what's been said about anarchists has covered most of the different types of anarchists. But I think the thing they probably all have in common is that they are obsessed with the state. The state does seem to be this big thing for them, which they think you can abolish without reference to the historical conditions of the time.
Okay. And Steve again.
Yeah, just something that's occurred to me, that if we were asked that question, you need to say, we're not anarchists at all. What we're trying to do is we're trying to get some order in society, trying to get some order into production. And the real anarchists in this society, the capitalist class, that refuse to, yes, sorry, that'll do.
Okay. If we've, I think we probably covered most, as John said, I think we've covered most of the various aspects of anarchism. Maybe it's time to move on to the next not at all contentious question. Here we go. You ready? Why is the Socialist Party so hostile to religion? Can't religious people have socialist beliefs too? Who wants to have a go at that? Okay, John Cumming.
I think religion is belief without a good reason to believe. In other words, without evidence. The gods, if they do exist, as people claim, have been winning the longest running game of hide and seek in the history of the world. So we would say that no evidence has ever been produced for the existence of these things called gods. And I would also say that socialism's not a belief system. It says, can't religious people have socialist beliefs too? We don't have beliefs as such. We tend to try and work on the evidence, and we would contend that socialism, far from being a belief system, is based on incontrovertible evidence. Had to get that word in. That's all.
All right. Thank you. Janet?
I would follow on from what John has just said about there's no evidence of there haven't been any gods in the past, and the idea that there has been is sort of so deeply within people because of the indoctrination that many of us suffer through our culture and maybe being or going to church. I think that there's some interesting books on the evolution of the idea of God and that sort of gods and that sort of thing, which may be enlightening, but perhaps people who only read them if they already want to be enlightened and learn and are, you know, with the shut minds that most religions seem to cause, doesn't leave them open to any discussion or arguments, I don't think. I also feel that if I were to really examine how I do feel about religion, I hate it. I think it's terrible. I think that the history of what religious people have done to each other over the centuries is appalling. And if only they would examine that idea, they might have second thoughts about following the idea of one particular religion or not. I think also it's embedded within cultures that they carry out horrific acts against themselves sometimes because of the idea of some background religion. I really hate the idea of Christmas, although I participate in it because my family do. But the business of this awful latest capitalist behaviour, which causes everybody to spend far too much money on far too many goods that nobody needs or hardly, and most children enjoy playing with the cardboard boxes rather than the toys that are inside them. Sorry, I could wander on, but I'll stop there and give someone else a chance.
Okay, well, nobody else is in the queue at the moment. I'm just thinking that we want to answer the question, can't religious people have socialist beliefs too? Rather than, you know, yeah, we don't agree with the religion, but lots of people say that. But what about the specific question, can't religious people have socialist beliefs? Howard?
Sorry, Paddy, I was just going to give a short answer again to that particular question. Why are you so hostile to religious ideas? My answer would be that we are not hostile to religious ideas, but we reject all ideas that stand in the way of democratic social revolution. And religion happens to be one of those, but we would say the same about so many others. So what I'm trying to do there is sort of to put religion in the same category as various other ideas we'd oppose, you know, call them what you like, sort of fascism or even sort of, you know, less extreme capitalist ideologies than fascism. In other words, don't deliberately cultivate hostility to beliefs that probably the majority of people in this country still have. Don't focus on those beliefs anyway.
Okay, thank you. Brian?
Yeah, just to point out that we don't court people for their religious beliefs to enter the Socialist Party, but at the same time, we don't object to them supporting the Socialist Party. It's not the same as having socialist beliefs. I mean, they can support because they recognize there are essential aspects of the socialist case that leads to peace and harmony.
Thank you. Janet?
To come back on whether some people, religious people, can support the party or can be socialists, I don't think that if you suggested to many religious people we're going to have a society that will be moneyless, I think they'd run away in horror. But I think that also there are an awful lot of people, religious people, that come over as being very kindly, very thoughtful, and indeed wishing themselves for a better society. But they still don't want to get together the coherent thought of a change in society. And as Brian has said, it doesn't really matter if they are still religious. They can support the party, but I think they might have to cross themselves before they do. Okay, thank you.
Lorna? Lonnie, you need to unmute.
Hello. Hiya, sorry. I guess my question is quite similar to, we're talking about religious people. I don't know. I suppose I want to go back to the anarchist question. Is that allowed or are we on another one now?
Well, we've kind of moved on to the next question now. Yeah, it would get very confusing if we jumped about, I think.
Okay, no worries.
Richard, you need to unmute.
Yeah, thanks, Paddy. I really struggle with this because I, as far as religion itself is concerned, I have no time for religion. But as far as the party membership is concerned, I think the primary reason, to me at any rate, why we don't admit religious people is because, or shouldn't admit them, is because people can't really serve two masters. You know, there are, if you take authoritarian religion like the Catholic Church or Muslim religion, where people are enjoined to do what their the authorities in that religion tell them to do, what are they going to do inside a democratic socialist party? I mean, how are they going to vote? The other half of me says, well, you know, if you immediately found people doing that, you could immediately expel them, so it wouldn't be a problem. So I'm really torn on that, and I don't really know. I'd be quite interested to hear what other people have to say about this. I've been rattling this around in my head for years. Yeah, because even if it's not an authoritarian organization, people are under a huge pressure to conform to established norms within, you know, if they belong to strong religious organizations. I guess in the Church of England it's not much of an issue, but as far as like some of the evangelical churches in America are concerned, you know, there's huge pressure on their members to conform to not just a religious but a political agenda as well. So that would be my main reason for objecting to religion. But I have no problems with people who are religious and are socialists, because I don't actually believe that most people are in fact rational in their ideas. And although it would involve a contradiction in their, you know, in sort of believing in Marxian socialist theory and also believing in some idealist religion, I think people are quite capable of having that irrational, making that sort of pigeonholing those ideas and just living out those ideas irrationally. Cheers. But yeah, I'd be really interested to hear what people think about the issues about membership.
Thanks, Richard. I'll come on to Dougie in just a sec, but I must interject us a little anecdote. My daughter was studying comparative religions at A level, and she just tore me off a strip for the party's attitude to religion. And she said, "Why have you got this attitude?" And I said, "Well, I suppose we argue that religious people are not rational." And she said, "Do you think that they're not rational all the time about everything?" And I said, "Well, no, I suppose not. I suppose they're rational about some things and not rational about other things." And then she said, "And do you think that socialists are rational at all times about everything?" And I had to admit, no, I didn't think they were either. There we are. So what's the problem, she said. Anyway, moving on to Dougie.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've got a major problem with this, really, you know, because if you look around the world, the number of Muslims, the number of Catholics, you know, the number of Hindus, the number of all the different religions, Buddhists and things. So, I mean, are we saying none of them can want socialism or whatever? So there is a problem there, really, you know, because we're talking large numbers of people, and it doesn't look like those ideas are going to die out pretty soon, right? I mean, I've got friends who are religious, but they understand the party case, so they're rational enough just to think that, you know, the party's right and how the world should be, really, you know. And I've talked to numerous people that are religious who agree with us. So I don't know. It is a difficult subject, really, you know. So, yeah, that's really all I wanted to say, really.
Okay, thanks, Dougie. I think we have had, actually, I don't know this for a fact, but I think we have had party members in the past who were religious but just kind of kept it under the radar. Yeah, what Richard said about serving two masters, well, you know, I think people can actually deal with that situation. So, anyway, Joel.
I think the important thing is whether, I mean, obviously, religious people are not going to sort of disappear when socialism comes in. But the important thing is that they want to work to make socialism, well, help to make socialism work. I think that's the top and bottom of it. I mean, and it's not just about them joining the Socialist Party or our sort of companion parties around the world. I mean, it's like people have said, that people do have their religious views and understand the case clearly. And the important thing is that with socialism, that they're working towards making socialism work, function the way it should do. I'm trying to keep it short. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. It occurred to me that the question, can't religious people have socialist beliefs? I think the easiest thing is to say, yeah, of course they can. And they could easily go and organise religious socialist organisations to get socialism. But where are these organisations? There aren't any. So it does seem to me that religious people are going back again to what Richard said about serving two masters. They're plainly much more interested in their religion than they are in social revolution. Otherwise, you'd be seeing these big organisations. Oh, sorry, John Cummings, come in. John.
Yes, just briefly, just to more or less echo what you've just said. You know, I think religious people really have to choose what's more important to them. If what's more important to you is that you've got some imaginary friend in the sky or whatever, and what's going to happen in the imagined afterlife, if that's all the sort of thing that's important to you, then of course it'd be damned impertinent of us to suggest that you don't obey your God. But so religious people really have to choose, what do they care about? This life, the only one that we all know about, or some imagined life in the sky after we die.
Okay, very succinct. Lorna?
Hi, yeah. Just in terms of what we're talking about, I mean, because I have many friends and colleagues who believe in ghosts. Now, sometimes that can be a relationship in relation to trauma. So I will often ask somebody who says they've seen a ghost tonight, is that sleep paralysis? Is it to do with, you know, do you experience the ghost? I don't know if anybody knows about sleep paralysis, but you know, it's an experience that somebody's sitting at the end of your bed or on your body or whatever. It's a scientific fact, but people experience it as supernatural. Now, lots of people turn to religion when they've had a loss, you know, for various other emotional reasons. Now, we're human beings, so. You know, I suppose what I'm saying is sleep paralysis is a scientific thing, but also we're human beings and we're emotional beings, and surely we can't just dismiss people for reacting emotionally or whatever and say that they're unscientific and they don't know the socialist case because of that, and that they should be not involved.
Yeah, thanks for that. Out of interest, I did actually experience sleep paralysis once, and it was the most incredibly weird thing. I couldn't explain it. It was just outside my sort of frame of reference. It didn't make me believe in ghosts or anything. I just had to put it on a sort of I don't know shelf for years and years and years until I finally came across the explanation for it. Really, really weird thing. Joel? Lorna, yeah, did you want to say something?
I was just saying it is quite scary, and that probably explains why lots of people say, think that they've seen ghosts or talk about ghosts or God even, you know.
Yeah, but that's quite possible, isn't it? Yeah. Joel?
Lorna Roo said a lot of what I was going to say, and so I'm not really going to say that much now. But just back to what you said, Paddy, about sort of religious people who believe, accept this party case, but we've not seen any of them sort of forming some sort of party, propagating it. But, I mean, you could say that about other people not religious who have certain views. I mean, either they hear the party case and they sort of like, they're not interested. And so, yeah, it was just to make that point. Thank you.
Thanks, Joel. Howard.
Paddy, you'd better not invite your daughter to one of these sessions, or she'll tie us in knots. My little story is that one of my nephews once told me that he'd been learning about religion in school. I said, "What do you think of it?" And his response was, "If you believe that, you believe anything."
Okay. Is it time to move on to the next question, I wonder? Nobody else is in the queue? I'm going to make an executive decision. So the next question is, capitalism is the basis of innovation and entrepreneurship. Why do you seem so opposed to this? Who wants to have a crack at that? I was just actually having a discussion about this very thing the other day with some people, arguing about it, in fact. Somebody tried to put the argument that capitalism is not the basis of innovation and entrepreneurship, or capitalism doesn't create innovation, but I think that's a very weak argument. Brian?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Right? You said it's a weak argument. I don't think it is a weak argument. We've seen examples of both in past societies, right? Innovation carries on, and people who think it's necessary to have a go in trading and so forth have done so. The question is, why do we seem so opposed to it, right? Because the basis that we are opposed to it is because the innovation is based towards market demand, and same as entrepreneurship, right? You know, that is also based on the market, and we're opposed to the market, not specifically these nuances or these byproducts of the market, right? That's all I got to say on that.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Just very quickly, capitalism is extremely innovative. I mean, we should all to tell people what Charlie Marx is. It's the most it's the type of system that has made the greatest strides in technology and productivity in any time in history. However, it's also extremely innovative when it comes to the means of killing people. This is where innovation occurs during war, and I don't think we'd really like to support that. But however, having said that, on the positive and not so positive side of capitalism, We've also got to point out to people that, as Brian was saying, these things are determined by the market. Therefore, we can point to, for example, kids dying in Africa due to malaria and to dehydration because they do not form a market. So it's absolutely market driven, and that is utterly insane as far as we should be concerned as human beings and as workers.
Okay, thanks. John Cumming.
I would say that innovation in capitalism is what we're against, the kind of innovation that you get in capitalism, and linked to entrepreneurship, it tends to be a thing that's not in our interest. It's usually innovation in profit-making and profit-making techniques, which benefit the very few and increase the misery of the many. And any innovations that there are in other things tend to be stymied if it's not profitable. So while we're in favour, we're not opposed to innovation as such, because after all, socialism is going to be one of the biggest innovations ever. Nevertheless, innovation as it shows itself in capitalism is not in the interests of the majority usually, and any innovation that does occur that doesn't serve the interests of profit usually gets squashed.
Oh, really? Actually, I like that idea, John, of getting out in front of this and saying we're far, far from being opposed to innovation and entrepreneurship. We socialists are the champions of innovation and entrepreneurship. Socialists are the ultimate entrepreneurs. Maybe that's a way to to take it. Janet?
I think that within capitalism, there are, as others have said, this drive for innovation, but it is driven by the profit motives usually, and any personal or private initiative that someone might have, unless they can fit into that system, they're not going to get much support. And often within the realms of their jobs, people are very searching for answers to questions, and you could hardly stop them. In socialism, those brains would still be searching and still be following through the interest that they have. I don't know if anyone's heard Bill Gates's book is being serialised on the radio on BBC4 at the moment. And he, it seems, when he first started, was really angry against government because they were stopping him being innovative and forging ahead with his ideas. But now he seems to be crying out for the help of governments to deal with the problems of the pandemic and the environmental crisis. So he's rather changed his tune on that. And I do feel that people are extremely interested in different aspects of all of our lives and would actually not be wanting to be stopped from following through on anything that they might be able to discover or create. And the other thing is, I think as somebody's already pointed out this, that we are faced with all this awful situation in the world today, and yet it hasn't stopped them still wanting to send spaceships up to investigate whichever planet is that they're wanting to get to just now. So millions of pounds and lots of brain power is being spent on those enterprises, which in the long term may be interesting, but really are not going to serve the majority of human beings at the time. Thank you.
Yeah, this is, just thinking about that, this is Elon Musk's philosophy that we're going to fuck the world, so we better start colonising other planets before we do. That's cheering, isn't it? Okay, Steve.
Yeah, just to come back, I'm slightly repetitive. We've said so far that it's the market that determines these innovations. Well, it's not just, it is in the end, it is the market that decides this. But what is the effect on us as the workers? The effect on us as workers of innovation in capitalism is generally speaking, a reduction in wages, which is That's what they're trying to do when they bring in machinery, is to get rid of workers, is to de-skill. And that's what we've seen all over. So it's that what is that, that to me is one of the most important things to take away for workers. That's our argument. This innovation is wonderful, except it's a double-edged sword, because as soon as you get more efficient more efficient production, you're also going to get a reduction in your wages. That's it.
Okay. I might take that point up with you at another time, Steve, because from what I see, it's the opposite of that. Workers are having to work harder and faster to learn more and more and constantly retrain for new jobs in the future. So it's not de-skilling, it's over-skilling. Most of that skills that you have to learn, you'll never get employed at. It's quite a horrible situation. Richard?
I would make a distinction. I think there are two quite separate questions in this question, because I don't think innovation and entrepreneurship are anything like the same thing. In terms of innovation, I go with absolutely what Steve said. Capitalism is by far the most innovative system that's ever actually existed on the earth. I mean, it's in the nature of capitalism. It's the law of value. It drives competition and forces, and because of competition on the market for survival, it forces innovation all the time. Of course, those innovations are not necessarily geared to meeting human need, and that might be an issue that you might want to raise. But as far as innovation is concerned, capitalism is also the preeminent system of waste and self-destruction. So, you know, it's like I think one of the party's old things that it used to kind of argue is it's three steps forward and two steps back all the time. Every time you actually you hit a crisis, then you're in a state of destruction rather than innovation. So I think there's a problem there. But the other problem is, and so just to follow that through, just because capitalism is a system of innovation, it doesn't mean it's the only system that could possibly innovate. And I could see that a socialist system which is highly focused on satisfying social need would also be innovative, but would be innovative in a very different way. As far as entrepreneurship is concerned, I think this is... the idea of the entrepreneur has become very, very popular recently, and I think that's riding on the back of right libertarian and sort of modern capitalist apologetics. This idea that capitalists are entrepreneurs, they go out because they have these fantastically innovative ideas and creative ideas. And I think this idea has come about as a result of the rise of the internet and sort of the cyberspace. And so I'm loose for the sort of generic term here, but you know what I mean, the rise of computing, in that it's a new technology, and a new technology always produces a huge new crop of new capitalists who come along with new ideas. And I think that's really what we're seeing at the moment. But most innovation is not actually created by capitalist entrepreneurs. It's actually a result of people in research and development departments, workers who are actually being employed, who are actually doing a lot of the innovating, you know, sort of admittedly behind such people as Steve Jobs, etc. But in a socialist society, the Steve Jobs would not be prevented from innovating. It would just simply be that he would be innovating as an equal member of society and not somebody who is an owner of capital. And he wouldn't be getting the value that all the people that were working for him innovating in the same way that, he wouldn't actually be receiving all the benefit of the innovations of other people in his employ. Okay, that's my thing.
It just occurred to me while you were talking there, Richard, that it would be possible to take a sort of, dare I say it, dialectical approach to the question. If you think about intellectual property, there's something really, really paradoxical about intellectual property. It sort of shows up some of the contradictions in capitalism. Intellectual property, patents, copyright. These are invented to protect people's innovations, and yet they also throttle innovation. They prevent innovation, and they create a lot of sideways development where, you know, people spend an awful lot of time and energy working around patents and reverse engineering stuff, you know, just so they can make a buck out of it. In a society that can actually patent human genes, you know, parts of your DNA, parts of your genome are actually patented. They're somebody's private property. Just shows up something of the contradictory nature of capitalism. Seeing as nobody else is in the queue, maybe it's time to move on to the next question, which I think was probably kind of going to be quite an easy question. This one is, do you believe in taxing the rich out of existence? Who would like to give a short, sharp response to that one? And John Cummings first up.
Yes, I think we can be fairly quick in dispatching this one and say that no, we don't believe in taxing the rich out of existence. We would say that they'll be voted out of existence. People, of course, will still be there, but they'll no longer belong to a social class of parasites, just as we, the wage slave class, will no longer be a wage slave class. There'll still be people just sharing a planet and trying to run society in the interests of everybody.
Okay, thanks. Howard?
Right. I'm unmuted, am I? Yeah, okay. Right, my answer is very much the same, but slightly different words, which is something like, no, we don't believe in taxing the rich out of existence. What we do believe in is a society of no rich and no poor, a society of economic equality. That's what we're aiming for, and that's what we're asking people to vote for.
Maybe we'd get further if we said that socialism was a system without taxes. Okay, anybody else? I don't think we don't need to dwell on this one, do we? I think that's a pretty easy one, unlike most of the others. So how's about we move on then? Don't people have the right to take home the fruits of their labour without it being taken in tax? Again, with a tax thing. This is quite an American thing, I seem to recall. Anybody? John Cumming, I think, is typing. Or not? Yes, John.
Okay, I was just put in the queue there. I didn't realise people could see I'd done that. I was waiting for someone else first. No, what I would say is, don't people have the right to take home the fruits of their labour without it being taken in surplus value? And I would ask the questioner, why do you support a tiny minority which lives off the unpaid labour of the working class?
Okay. The thing with that is that we know what you mean, but I imagine a TV audience might be a bit baffled by terms like surplus value, possibly. Kind of the aim of the... If we were to get a good answer to this, it would be something that your sort of normal TV audience would completely get straight away. Not that I've got a suggestion. Anyone like a go? Oh, Dougie's going to have a go. Go on, Dougie.
Yeah, I just think you could put examples, right? You could say people who work in the Rolls-Royce factory or whatever, making Rolls-Royce cars or whatever, they do the work to produce them, but they can't own them, right? You know, people that own them are the rich people. They probably have shares in the company or whatever. So the society we want is a society without tax and without money, where we share things commonly, really, you know. So I think you can put the case that society's rigged for the rich at the moment. And you can give examples of Bill Gates being the fourth richest man in the world, owning more land than anybody else in the world. So, I mean, you could say we want to take that away from them, right, and share the world with everybody, right? You know.
Okay, thank you. Janet?
This is a difficult question because people don't want to be seen to be taking off of others, I think, and it implies that you would be if you didn't agree with taxation. Is it personal taxation, private taxation, or is it the, I don't know, corporate tax that we're talking about here? If people aren't allowed to... If people were able to take the fruits of their labour, then they wouldn't be part of the taxation system, because that's apparently, in most people's eyes, taking something away from them. I think perhaps we have to get back to basic and ask, well, how is it that we all need food, clothing and shelter, but and no one can live without most of those, and yet there are some people who don't go to work, don't have to work, can do really sort of expensive things like buy private planes and yachts and things like that, who don't work, and yet they do derive benefit from what the majority of us produce. And why is that, and how is that? And then I think perhaps it might lead to deeper questions.
Yeah, I think this question is a bit of a... Well, I think of it as an American question, because I associate it with a sort of libertarian right obsession with getting rid of the state and just everybody gets their wages and there's no tax. You know, they take home what they suppose is the full product of their labour, which, of course, it isn't. But this question is kind of an amalgam of two different things. First of all, it's talking about... Can you take home the full fruits of your labour? And that's really a question about surplus value. And then the second part is without it being taken in tax, which is a completely separate question about the whole tax argument, which in my experience, nobody ever seems to understand, or maybe it's just when I explain it, but no one ever seems to get the tax argument. So which way do you go with a question like this? Do you go down the surplus value route, or do you go down the tax route? I would say... You know, if I spend all day making a table for an employer and the table retails for £10, then if I take £10 as wages for the table, I've got the full fruits of my labour. But where does my employer get his profit from in that case? So I think that would be my stab at it, and leave the tax question out of consideration. Quite a difficult one. Anybody else want to say anything on that? Oh, Steve.
I mean, the way this question's this is the problem. We've just got to cover everything. We've got to cover the fact that, hang on, why does it appear that you are paying? Is it because you've, it appears as though you're there to state. If there's no taxation, you don't have any social, these services, which have been shown to be more economically, if the capitalist class are taxed by the state. So it's just the way that this is framed. Brilliant illustration of why we could do with a few little workshops. I'm sorry to bang on about this. I didn't say it before, but this is a sort of you can't win with this. You can't win with this answer you've got unless you're willing to go into everything. Your wages are not the fruits of your labour. They are the equivalent of the labour that's gone into creating. It's just like it just opens up an entire an entire set of arguments that we'd be able, I don't know whether you could actually bring it all together to put it into a nutshell so that you could get it onto Brian's 4 minute interview. But I think this is a perfect argument for showing why we need these looking workshops. That'll do.
All right, thank you for that plug, Steve.